Welcome to the Standing Up to POTS podcast, otherwise known as the POTScast. This podcast is dedicated to educating and empowering the community about postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, commonly referred to as POTS. This invisible illness impacts millions, and we are committed to explaining the basics, raising awareness, exploring the research, and empowering patients to not only survive, but thrive. This is the Standing Up to POTS podcast.
Hello, fellow POTS patients and fabulous people who care about POTS patients. I'm Jill Brook, your horizontal host, and today we are interviewing Calum Shield, who is senior exercise physiologist and founder of Lofty Health and Wellness in Australia, and also a patient himself. With over 15 years of experience, Calum specializes in managing complex invisible conditions such as POTS, ME/CFS, Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, hypermobility, long COVID, fibromyalgia, you know the whole batch. He comes recommended by the wonderful Australian POTS Foundation and works with them. And today we're going to discuss some of the latest, greatest therapies Calum is using to help get patients the best results. Calum, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jill. It's great to be here. I am a really big fan of the POTScast and something that I listen to on a regular basis. So yeah, it's brilliant to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. And, you know, it's fun that we were just discussing that your wife is your partner and she's an occupational therapist who also works with the same population. So I'm guessing that means that you guys are probably always discussing both sides. So you probably have, you know, expertise in the occupational therapy side of things too.
Yeah, a little bit. Yes. Yeah. So I typically sort of focus mostly on some of the non-pharmacological strategies for POTS, and obviously exercise is a part of that. But yeah, there is a little bit of crossover with that in terms of aids to be able to help people as well. So it's something that, yeah, we often do talk about strategies for other patients, but also I guess she's been there right throughout my own journey as well as amazing support. And I must admit, I've sort of been someone who's kind of roped her into working with this population group as well. And I guess, you know, some therapists, I guess, you are just sort of made for working with this population group. So her empathy and understanding and all of those sorts of things is quite incredible, and something that I've been fortunate enough to kind of experience firsthand myself, but then in a professional sense, yeah, it's something that, yeah, she's able to provide quite significantly too.
Yeah. I always think it's fun how like marital osmosis makes you pretty knowledgeable at whatever your spouse is talking about all the time. So that's cool. But okay, so let's get to know more about you. Can you tell us more about your background and how you became an expert in dysautonomia and all of these invisible illnesses and how you came to do what you're doing now?
Yeah, and so I guess you've provided a really good summary before in terms of my background, which is really, really nice to hear from a professional sense. And I'm really lucky here, I guess, locally in Adelaide in South Australia. We've got a POTS clinic that's set up specifically for treating POTS patients. And it's something that I'm connected in with that clinic as well. So, and together with the clinic, we've obviously got the research group from Adelaide. And so I sort of touch base there too, sort of professionally, which is great in the small amount of, I guess, spare time that I have too. But I guess, like, particularly in Australia, like so many of our therapists over here that work with POTS, my own personal journey, I guess, is something that led me to working with this population group. So I guess, from quite a young age, so in adolescence, I was always one of those kids that would get quite dizzy when standing up too fast, or particularly if standing still as well. So I guess it was something for me that I've always sort of recognized, and I do have quite a lot of the hypermobile trait, so I suspect it's probably linked to that. And so my first job, I remember, like at the local supermarket, where I would be quite dizzy getting up from sort of squatting down, stacking a shelf, and you'd get what we, I guess, know as presyncope. And yeah, quite dizzy off the back of that. And for me, I used to play Australian rules football was my sport. And I guess the Australian listeners would understand. And I guess in the US, there's some similarities with NFL football, minus the helmets. And so concussions are quite common, which I've had several of. And I wonder how much those concussions maybe play a role. But my first POTSy episode was during uni. So I used to park my car quite away from uni and walk in. And I was walking one day and then stopped walking at the traffic light. And because I was standing stationary, and I didn't really know what it was at that time, but I had a very pre-syncope episode. So, essentially everything kind of blacked over and I started to have that real hyperadrenergic response. And the kind of catch 22 was that I was actually opposite our main hospital in Adelaide at the time. And I presented to ED and they kept ops and administered a couple of bags of fluid, and fluid's amazing for POTS, isn't it? And so I didn't really sort of consider that too much, I guess, for another couple of years until we had quite a traumatic event in our family. So my sister passed away when I was 21, and I guess the trauma associated with that was something that impacted my nervous system quite substantially, but it never really sort of changed too much, I guess. Like, I was left with that even with some of the emotional processing that comes with such a traumatic event. It was something that continued to have quite an impact on my body physically after that. And I guess that's when I really started to notice those really common symptoms of like headaches and brain fog and fatigue were sort of my really big symptoms at that time. And I remember keeping like a headache journal and it was how bad that headache was for 6 months. So I could give it to the doctor and there were rarely days without one. And finally got that diagnosis, which was initially sort of autonomic dysfunction and later on POTS. And it sort of required a lot of adjustments day to day. So I had to give up my AFL footy and took up mountain bike riding, which is something that I still do and something that I can do. I still have to manage what I do with that, but it's something from a movement perspective that I can do. And for me, diet has a massive impact. So I had to really overhaul the dietary component, which I know that you know very well. And I guess then the next stage for me is I didn't realize how well I was pacing until we had our children. So we're very blessed to have a couple of young kids, and that next sort of flare or big change in my POTS was sort of after our second child was born. I didn't realize how much I needed to pace. And that's when I guess, transitioned from my typical exercise physiology work in the background for sort of the 10 years prior to that to just working with POTS and co. So I was doing a bit of both. So seeing people with POTS and co, and in Australia, we'll see people for exercise physiology for things like diabetes or heart disease. But at that time, I connected in with the POTS clinic here and was really fortunate to be able to just work in that space, which I love. And we've been doing it for 3 years now, or a bit over 3 years, which is amazing.
Wow, and that's fantastic that they have, you know, somebody who's really been there and understands that they can send all of their POTS patients too. That's phenomenal. So I'm curious. So given that you've worked with sort of patients who have things like diabetes and cardiovascular disease, how are POTS and invisible illness patients different? Like, what kinds of challenges and goals do you help patients with now that you have this population?
Yeah, I guess with a typical population, like, particularly as an exercise physiology background, exercise legitimately is, and there's brilliant research to suggest that exercise, and the more we do, the better, essentially helps to regulate that. And I think we all know, and I'm certainly personally familiar, and I know you are as well, where there's our perfect amount of movement. That may not be structured exercise for some people, but there's our perfect amount of movement. And then it's a really fine line between not enough and too much. And that's where I guess I love that investigative work behind that and helping people to find what that baseline is for them. And so typically sort of now I work with a really broad range of patients. So often they're between sort of bed housebound all the way through to elite athletes with POTS. So the way that we manage that is very, very different in terms of what we do from a non-pharmacological standpoint for their POTS and exercise.
So just for the people out there who are being still told in 2025 that their POTS is at least partially due to their own deconditioning, you're saying that you have elite athletes that still have POTS. So for them, obviously, deconditioning could not be any part of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I guess where we do see where the deconditioning component can come in is that secondary deconditioning. So something that I do talk about with people where, hey, if we stop doing that thing that we've normally done, our body's not going to be accustomed to doing that straight away again. So there's going to be that lack of ability to slot straight back into that thing. But yeah, it's completely autonomic. Like it's the autonomic nervous system or that automatic part of the body that responds to the movement and then recovery from the movement or the demand on the person that is going to have much more of an influence than purely, I guess, how their heart functions, which is only an incredibly small part. So if we look at it, like there might be still maybe a percent or something like that of all the POTS patients that might legitimately present with that deconditioning, but it's so tiny. And particularly for the average POTS patient, if there is one, it's just not a consideration.
So, you know, this is making me think of a question that I have had for myself for a long time, and I'm going to assume enough other POTS patients have it that I'm going to take the liberty to ask you. I find that doing the same exercise at 8 a.m. is so much harder than doing it at 3 p.m. Is that a thing in POTS?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'd say it's not. There's no typical. So we do see some people where they do cope with morning movement better. And there's a variety of reasons for that, I think. But I guess from my insights, it can come down to that ability for us to build blood volume as we start the day, perhaps begin to use up some of that adrenaline, push some blood around the body. I guess the physiology that's required for us to be sleeping looks and where our body has to push blood and what our autonomic nervous system does is very different to what it looks like once we've been maybe up and moving a little bit, even if that is just from room to room for some people. And then also we've got that diurnal component of POTS of the fact that typically a typical presentation with things like orthostatic intolerance will look a little bit different in the afternoon compared to the morning. So basically we'll be a little bit more potsy in the morning than the afternoon.
Okay. Good to know. So you said something really intriguing a minute ago, and I was wondering if we could dig a little deeper. You said a big thing that you do for patients is help them find that perfect amount of exercise for them where it's enough, but not too much. Can you talk more about how you help people do that?
Yeah. So I guess first of all, with patients, it's about trying to sort of learn their goals for movement. So a typical sort of goal for most of our POTSies will be just to improve that daily function and improve their POTS and EDS management as well. But something that I typically will use is technology that we have available now. So things like heart rate monitoring devices and heart rate variability that can, I guess, bring some of those invisible aspects that we have with POTS and autonomic dysfunction to make them a little bit more quantifiable or objective in nature. And so it's something, I guess, that I typically will help people sort of to learn, okay, where's that intersection between how our body's reacting and then also what the data is saying for that particular day to help guide us. And then off the back of that, I'll tend to help people with sort of that full range of non-pharmacological strategies. So that can look at things like salt and fluid. We might touch briefly on diet, but we've got great dietitians and nutritionists here that are POTS specialists and aware. So I tend to sort of refer those on vagus nerve stimulation as well. So things like breath work and similar, and hopefully we can touch on some of the other vagus nerve stimulation strategies today.
Yeah.
And then even trialing things like compression boots as well. So I know you've mentioned before on the podcast about compression boots and how they may play a role for some people. So,
and when you say compression boots, you mean the ones that are inflatable and like squeeze blood up your leg?
That's the one. Yeah. And obviously they have quite a short lasting effect, but it's something, again, that requires little effort to implement. So if someone can't, I guess, do the movement to be able to squish that blood mechanically back, or if there's a medication like Mitogen here in Australia, which is a common medication prescribed to push some of that venous blood back up towards our heart and brain. If they don't get along with that, or they're already at a maximum dose, how can we look at other strategies to perhaps help with pushing that blood back for recovery and day-to-day function?
Yeah, for sure. So you have all kinds of cool technology that you use. Let's talk about some of it. Where do you want to start? You mentioned heart rate variability. We want to cover that.
Yeah.
Vagus nerve stimulation. We want to cover that. And anything else you want to talk about, but where should we start?
Yeah, well, maybe the vagus nerve stimulation side of things, if you like, because that's something that I guess is really interesting, the vagus nerve side of things. And I guess this is where sometimes it can be helpful having POTS yourself to be able to try things yourself before the evidence is there, and also to kind of gain an understanding of what sort of impacts it might have on your body. And so for me, my first experience with particularly the transcutaneous vagus nerve stimulation, which is sort of something relatively new in this space, was on myself, because we didn't have the research there a couple of years ago, and particularly on POTS, there wasn't the research. And so it was something that, I guess, as an emerging strategy, I was like, oh, I'll give this a go myself and see what sort of use it has. And yeah, from there, it sort of developed into a tool that we can control with people. Would it be useful to maybe touch on what the vagus nerve does for people?
Yeah,
in this
absolutely.
Context?
Give us the whole spiel.
Yeah. So the vagus nerve is a refresher, because I know you've talked about it on the podcast before with people, but the vagus nerve essentially has quite a substantial amount of parasympathetic fibers. So about 75%, I guess they sort of indicate. And because of that, it's got quite a large role in promoting more of that rest, digest, sort of parasympathetic nervous system state in our body. And the way that I often sort of describe this with people is, if you can imagine a car where we've got an accelerator and a brake pedal, and in a car, our foot is usually on one or the other, but in our body, we need really good balance between that brake and accelerator. And one of the common things with POTS, I guess, is that our foot is a little less on the brake than it needs to be, and a little bit more on the accelerator. And so we get a lot more of that sympathetic flight nervous system activity starting to shine through with a lot of people with POTS. And I guess that's where the vagus nerve stimulation comes in, is it helps us to kind of dab that brake pedal a little bit more to get a bit more balance between the two and more optimal sort of function of that vagus nerve. And other types of vagus nerve stimulation typically are things like breath work that we kind of touched on before. There's some broader research around things like laughter and humming and gargling and those sorts of things as well.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
So I have tried all of those things, because I definitely am a person where, like, as you make this metaphor about having the foot on the gas too much and not enough on the brake, I'm laughing because in my head, this metaphor ends in, you know, crashes. But but so I've tried a lot of those things and I've never felt a difference. Like, do people feel it when it's working? Like, do you know? And I've tried a couple of the different devices and I've tried the gargling and the laughing. And I don't know if I haven't done it enough or if I haven't found the right device or if you just, it's something that works without you necessarily feeling anything.
Yeah. And so for some people, what we're learning with some of the basic research that they've done on TVNS especially is that for some people, it actually, they won't notice a difference. But for the next person, they have a profound sort of, or they can notice a profound difference or profound impact on their function. And for some people, that can be immediate, where they notice improved blood flow to the brain. So they feel like they've got clearer thinking. They feel like they've got more of a calm nervous system. They can feel like they've got more energy in some instances as well. But in others, they, and I guess in that research that we'll touch on in a moment, if you want to cover that, is even with the TVNS, they found that as a group, they didn't notice an impact on their symptoms as a whole. But when we actually went and discussed with the researchers around it, which our team in Adelaide was fortunate enough to be able to discuss with them, they found some really profound impact in some people. But in others, even though their standing tests improved and their heart rate variability improved and their inflammatory markers improved, they didn't actually notice any difference.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah, so I wonder if that might be a similar thing in your instance as well. And that's where I guess what I still encourage for people is, like, we can try all of these different vagus nerve strategies and there's a set amount that we can try, and it's not anything that you've done wrong necessarily. If you haven't noticed a difference, it's just your nervous system in terms of how it responds.
So for how long do you typically have people try it before they give up? Like a week or 6 months or?
Yeah, so oftentimes, are you talking about the vagus nerve, some of those other strategies that you've tried, or the TPNS?
Well, whatever you tell people to do.
Yeah. So I guess for all of those different strategies, I mean, if we're not starting to notice a difference within a couple of weeks, like generally for most people, it's enough time to, I guess, ride out those normal ups and downs that we see in POTS. And so if our body is in more of a parasympathetic state on one day or a more of a sympathetic state on another day, there is potential that our body could respond a bit differently to those. And so it lets us have enough data points to be able to give it a really good go to see what sort of impact it's having on our body. Some of the other vagus nerve strategies that we talked about before, we've also in recent times been using things like TVNS. So that's called transcutaneous auricular, which is ear-based vagus nerve stimulation. And for short, it will be called either TVNS or TAVNS is some of the acronyms. And I guess where I see it can be quite appealing for people is for people who don't have the energy to be able to try some of those other strategies that we talked about, because even breath work requires some energy for us to do. Sure. And so for people who are quite bedbound and unable to maybe try some of those active strategies, it can be useful. And essentially what it is a low-grade electrical stimulation of the vagus nerve through the tragus of the ear. And so we clip a little clip, a special clip onto the ear, and that electrical stimulation is at a level that's a bit less than the sensation threshold. So you actually don't need to feel it to be effective. And it's quite similar, the machine that they use, to a TENS machine that some people might have heard of for pain. And some people, including myself, will use a TENS machine, but I guess it's really, really critical. So if anyone goes down that pathway, you just have to make double sure that it's actually set up appropriately, because you don't want it to cause complications because it's not set up appropriately. And the reason that the tragus is ideal is that it's quite close to where the vagus nerve passes through. And so I guess that as a whole, giving you sort of a summary of what the TVNS does, of the study that they conducted and published on by Stavrakis and colleagues in 2024, where they took 26 people and they randomized them. So they got half the group to hook it onto the tragus and then the other half to hook it onto the earlobe.
Okay, so two different parts of the ear. So they thought they were getting the transcutaneous vagal nerve stimulation, but they weren't. They were just having a clip on their ear that was vibrating a little in the wrong place to matter.
Yeah. So really interesting. So I guess from a study design perspective, it was great because we're going to see quite meaningful results. And it was only small. So like a lot of POTS papers, it was only 26 participants, but they did that vagus nerve stimulation for an hour a day in that particular study, which clinically use of vagus nerve stimulation doesn't need to be that long is what we find for individuals. And the frequency that they had their stimulator set up was 20 hertz and 200 microseconds. And they followed them for a couple of months. And what they found was, like I sort of touched on before, improved orthostatic tolerance with a standing test. They saw reduced autoantibodies as well with, in terms of their blood markers and inflammatory cytokines, and increased heart rate variability. But as I mentioned before, unfortunately, as a group, they didn't all see that impact in terms of function.
Wow, but you're making me think that for those of us who have a vagal nerve stimulator sitting around anyway, we should probably use it for my next question is going to be how many minutes a day, because if it reduces, especially for those of us who know we have some autoimmunity, because if it reduces autoantibodies and helps your other markers, cytokines, you said, so inflammation, that sounds like that's going to pay off some way somehow, even if you're not feeling it.
Yeah, and potentially, and that's the thing, I guess, and that's where we're really fortunate to have our local research group that I contribute to, Dr. Celine, who had a conversation with the researchers about, well, what did we notice? And there were some people that were like, give this thing to me. It's amazing. It's changed my life so much. And then others in that same intervention group that just didn't notice anything. And I guess that's where every individual is going to then potentially determine, well, is it a good use of my time having this thing clipped onto my ear if I don't feel anything, but it may help some of that, those autoimmune markers. And I guess that's what our clinical experience has been as well. So I've used it with probably between 200 and 250 patients now, where we'll trial it in clinic, some of them just for a session or two, or some people it's in their own home if I'm seeing them there. And from that, we'll then decide, is it worth a longer trial of a couple of weeks to see what sort of impact? And some people don't notice any benefit until we withdraw it and stop using it. And they're like, oh, actually, this is having an impact on my sleep or something of that nature.
So how long do you usually have your patients do it for per day?
Yeah, so typically, because there is such variation in terms of response, because we can hit that brake pedal too hard for people as well. So going back to that analogy of, for some people, we can overstimulate the vagus nerve and that can ironically present as feeling too parasympathetic, so too lethargic, too heavy. So what we typically do is start off with, for someone who is really, really sensitive, it could even be 1 minute per day. But typically, depending on how people are tolerating things, about 5 minutes a day. And then they can slowly titrate it up if they feel like they're not hitting the brake pedal too hard. And that can gradually increase really until people start to notice some sort of improvement. And I guess a good clinical compromise, if someone doesn't feel that improvement in terms of symptoms, but they may want to use it for other means, a good compromise might be between 15 and 30 minutes per day of seeing some of those benefits with some of the inflammatory markers, but not having the time to be able to do something that may not improve their symptoms.
So that's great. And so you provide that to your patients so that they don't have to go out and spend a few hundred dollars and buy one. They can try yours first and see if they're benefiting.
Correct. Yeah. So we've got a few different ways that we can do that. Like we'll just do it during an appointment for people. If I'm seeing them face to face, it's a bit more difficult to do that if I see people via telehealth, unless they have a device themselves. But yeah, we can try that a few times. We're looking at starting a little bit of a program that we can provide some education around what vagus nerve stimulation is, help people with that, and then provide them with a loan machine for 6 or 8 weeks so they can actually give it a go before they go and purchase it as well. But yeah, that's something that I guess I'm really big on, because it's really costly to live with POTS with all of the strategies that we have to implement. So if we can try something before we have to buy it, it's a big win in my books.
Amen. Very cool. Okay, so is there anything else to say about the vagal nerve stimulation before we move on to the next therapy?
Yeah, so probably the only other thing to mention, just for people, I guess, a bit like yourself, where you're like, is this something that may or may not help for me? Of, I guess, clinically, what we tend to notice of, is there a difference between people who might respond and may not respond without actually being able to trial? What we notice from a clinical sense, so it's not research, but certainly clinical observation of people who have more of a hyperadrenergic presentation with their POTS are people who we typically will notice perhaps a little bit more benefit from something like the TVNS than others who may have a slightly different presentation with their POTS. And obviously no one person with POTS is typically sort of bound by just the hyperadrenergic presentation. So how much of a factor that is for people will vary as well. So,
okay, but that's great. Great information. Fantastic. Okay. And so you had said one of the things that the vagus nerve stimulation was found to affect and improve was the heart rate variability. Do you want to talk about what that is and how you use it?
Yeah. So that's another area that I love working with people, a bit like I sort of touched on before. It gives us something objective to be able to look at home, essentially, to be able to give us a bit of an understanding, or more of an understanding, of how our nervous system might be responding, I guess, uniquely for that particular day, but also as a whole over a lengthy period of time as well. So as we start to implement changes, what sort of trends are we seeing and those sorts of things. So heart rate variability, I guess, in this instance is something that we're looking more so at the time domain. And so that is very small changes in each beat and the time between each beat of our heart. And the thing that obviously impacts that quite profoundly is our autonomic nervous system. And they're so small, those changes, that they're measured in milliseconds. So they're really, really small. And HRV as a mechanism is something that's really personal. So your HRV will be quite different to mine, for instance. So it's really difficult to compare heart rate variability between people or even POTSies, but something that we can do is look at our own heart rate variability compared with our own personal baseline to give us some insight into our nervous system.
And the thing that always sort of seems counterintuitive to me is I think higher variability is better, right? Like, you don't actually want your heart rate to be perfectly uniform. You want it to be a little like irregular from beat to beat. Is that right?
Yeah. So, and this is one of the things, I guess, and it's so interesting to look at. And the reason for that is because our autonomic nervous system is constantly interpreting information that's fed through all of our senses and determined by our brain. And so because we are biological systems, our bodies need to respond to all of those different bits of information quite quickly. And that is partly driven by the autonomic nervous system. And they did a study on POTS, a review study, might have been 2019, looking at heart rate variability as a POTS group as a whole and a healthy control as a whole, and saw the POTS group had a reduced heart rate variability. And I guess that has left a lot of people, when they look at HRV, of, oh, I just want to get it higher. And as we'll hopefully chat about a bit more, when our HRV is higher for a particular day, it may not actually always mean that we feel great. It might mean that our body is in actually an overly freeze or parasympathetic nervous system state for that particular day. As we see those changes in the nervous system occur by the body trying to maintain that homeostasis, what we can see is that the body, particularly if our body is having quite an overly sympathetic response for a period of time, that's really exhausting on our body and uses a lot of resources and energy. And the body will try and push us towards a more of a parasympathetic state to be able to help with recovery. And that's when we will often start to feel, really heavy, a lot more lethargic fatigue rather than that real wired, tired sort of fatigue. And oftentimes, I know me personally, those overly parasympathetic days compared to my baseline are the ones where I feel a lot worse, because my heart rate is usually lower and my blood pressure is also really low. So we get heaps less blood coming back up, and together with that really heavy lethargic, often for me, it's fluey sort of symptoms as well on those days for people. And it's quite a common presentation across the people that I work with, where for that day, if we're seeing more of a parasympathetic state, it may not always be an ideal state for our body.
So can you talk a little bit more about how you use this in the clinic and how you measure it? So do you have people wear like a device that is giving you real-time feedback, or how does it work and how do you use it?
Yeah, so I guess that's where it's come from historically. So historically, with things like ECG devices and Holter monitors is the only way really that we could get heart rate variability insights. But where it's much more useful clinically is with some of the technology in recent years. So sort of the last decade to two, we've started to see chest strap heart rate monitors and even smartwatches and apps built into our phones that analyze blood flow in the context of apps and smartwatches, and chest straps monitor the heart rate itself in terms of electrical signals. And what we can then do is with an app is to start looking at what someone's personal baseline might be. And once we've established someone's personal baseline, we can then get some feedback either from their HRV overnight with, say, a watch, a smartwatch, or a morning check-in at a really standardized time in a standardized way to be able to capture their heart rate variability and then provide them with some insight into where their body is for that day.
And so, for example, I know some athletes, my hearing about this is not that recent, so this might be out of date by now, but I know for a while I was hearing about athletes who would measure their heart rate variability, and they would, on a day where their heart rate variability was high, they'd say, okay, I can do a really hard workout today. But on a day when their heart rate variability was low, they'd say, oh, I should take it more easy today. Is that valid? Is that something that you do, or how do they think about it now?
Yeah. So that's essentially what we'll look at. And that was actually my own personal experience with it as well, of like my first experience with this chest strap heart rate monitor is what we had at the time, I guess probably 12, 12 to maybe 15 years ago when I was still attempting to partake in sport and monitoring this and obviously seeing these wild swings between sympathetic and parasympathetic. But yeah, in more recent times, what we've been able to do is adapt some of that use for athletes across to using it for invisible illness. And I guess how we look at it with invisible illness rather than low HIV is back off and high HIV is sort of go, is with invisible illness, oftentimes it's if it's within our personal baseline and context is really important for POTS. So, and that person is feeling like they're not having a horrendous day as well. So it's really important to consider symptoms that we can then probably proceed forward with, say, plan A, if we're looking at, say, like a plan of strategies. And then if their heart rate variability is actually lower than baseline, we might look at a plan B. And then if their HRV is much higher than baseline, we might implement a plan C. So it really helps us kind of individualize and personalize that approach for the day.
Do you see or do you know of any findings around people with post-exertional malaise or myalgic encephalomyelitis and what their heart rate variability does?
So there was a paper looking at that as well on heart rate variability as a cohort, which was almost identical to POTS. So as a cohort, their HRV was lower than the healthy controls. And so really similar in terms of how we look at that and approach that as what we look at with POTS. And I guess that low heart rate variability finding is not necessarily unique in the context of invisible illness. So if we look at a lot of chronic illnesses, so even looking at research such as MS, which obviously has a lot of autonomic overlap as well, some cancers as well, they've looked at heart disease, and a lot of those do also indicate lower heart rate variability compared to the general population. So whether that is because of some of the inflammation associated with these conditions or the autonomic impacts, that's the tricky thing with HRV, is it's not super specific, but it's really sensitive.
And that's so interesting. And so I wanted to ask you, it seems like we hear about some POTS and invisible illness patients who make these great recoveries, and then we hear about others who they do all the right things and they put in the time and the effort and they don't improve very much. Do you clinically notice anything that predicts which of your patients tend to have better comebacks or?
I don't. And it's really hard. Like I wish I did. And I think it is a broader reflection of that heterogeneity of POTS and how individualized, I guess, each person with POTS is. So I guess if you've met, although we all have overlaps, if you've met one person with POTS, you've sort of met one person with POTS, and the next person will present a little bit differently. And I guess as an example, a couple of examples of that, like there are some of the elite athletes that I've worked with over the years that unfortunately they can only return back to maybe very minimal light exercise and had a lot of difficulty getting past that. And then on the flip side, we have some people who have been bedbound for years and make incredible improvement once we've sort of been able to understand fully what's happening with their body and really exhaust and try all of those strategies. So it's, yeah, I guess over a lengthy period of time, though, if we can accumulate those things in our toolkit by learning and trialing things and understanding how they may be helpful or not helpful and place them in our toolkit or exclude them from that toolkit or maybe to retrial in the future, we can see improvement. But yeah, unfortunately, we still see people where they can't get back to reaching those goals that they would want to.
So let's end with something really optimistic. Can you tell us a story of one of your POTS patients who was like what you just said, where they maybe were sort of homebound or even bedbound and ended up being able to recover quite a lot? Like, what did you do? What were they able to do at the beginning and at the end? And like, what therapies did you use with them?
Yeah, I've got a couple of quicker stories kind of come to mind immediately. One really recently that I've reviewed, and ironically, somewhat, this person had quite a flair. I was working with them beforehand, but they had quite a flair around the time of our POTS conference here last year. So that was March 2024. And now we fast forward a bit over a year, and that had a substantial flair to where they were back in bed. Their management was all over the place, and they had to have some adjustments medication-wise, and we went back to sort of basic non-pharmacological management. And this person's goal was to get back doing some running, and bearing in mind at that time they couldn't walk really from room to room. And so we had gradually sort of worked on that and stabilizing with their cardiologist over a period of time. And they actually just completed a half marathon a couple of weeks ago, which is quite incredible.
Oh my gosh.
And in that case, it was a combination of everything. So it wasn't just my input, obviously. It was some of the medications that needed adjustment, and really touching on the salt fluid diet and support. And yeah, they were able to get back to doing that half marathon, which was quite incredible. And I guess the other one that comes to mind as well, if I can quickly touch on it, is someone who, again, quite incredible progress, where this person was bedbound for quite some period of time with an ME/CFS diagnosis, but then wanted to explore a POTS diagnosis a little bit further to see how much that might be an influence for them. And with implementing all of the POTS management strategies, so salt fluid, compression, the movement, pacing, and the addition of a few medications as well, this person over a good few years has progressed to the point where they've been able to get back to uni, study, and now into the workforce and looking at getting into a house with their partner and moving to a different place. And so it's given them a whole new lease on life, which is quite incredible.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it's absolutely amazing how different every POTS patient is. And it's funny because I realized that people like you, you could have taken probably a much easier professional route and worked with a community where it was just cookie cutter, do the same thing every time. And I know that the POTS patients don't make it easy for you every time you have to.
But that's what really I like, think. I guess. For me, that's what I love, like that investigative work that we have to do with POTS is so, I guess, rewarding for myself, but it's something that I do find actually really enjoyable and fulfilling. And even those small gains, I mean, those couple of instances there were quite remarkable examples, but even the small gains that we all see every day are incredible, and we need to celebrate those as well.
That's a good point. When I was at my worst, I used to always remind myself that going from 0 to 1 is the only time you get a boost of infinity, and going from 9 to 10, that's almost nothing. Going from 0 to 1 is the real 100%. Real step.
Yeah, 0 to 1, and then it's double from 1 to 2, and it gets that little bit easier each time from there. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. We're so excited to get to know you and to see how knowledgeable and dedicated you are to this community and to have you as a resource. Do you have any final thoughts or parting message for people?
Yeah, I guess from my side of things is just continue to find that team around you and surround that team, or surround yourself with that team that is going to work with you. They don't need to be a POTS expert necessarily. And I know you've mentioned that numerous times, of just finding those people around you that are willing to work with you and to help do that investigative work and to help support you along the way. And I guess the fact that like POTS is a really challenging condition to live with and for us as health professionals as well to manage. But I guess going back to that toolkit analogy before, of if we can keep putting things in that toolkit that we can call on, we can see some really steady progress over time.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you for always looking for the next good tool. Where can people find you online if they want to learn more about your clinic?
Yeah, so I guess our website is probably a good spot. So that's just loftyhealth.com.au. We've got Facebook and Instagram. It's not overly used, but we do have the socials there. And for me personally, I guess more so professionally, if people want to connect, I am on LinkedIn as well. So just through my name, Calum Shield. But yeah, thank you so much, Jill. It's been amazing to chat with you today. So good.
Well, likewise. Thank you so much. We'll put all those links in the show notes. So if anybody wants to find you easily, they can just go there and click. So, Calum, thanks a million. It's been great talking to you. And okay, listeners, that's all for today. We'll be back soon with another episode. But until then, thank you for listening. Remember, you're not alone. And please join us again soon.
As a reminder, anything you hear on this podcast is not medical advice. Consult your healthcare team about what's right for you. This show is a production of Standing Up to POTS, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. You can send us feedback or make a tax-deductible donation at www.standinguptopots.org. You can also engage with us on social media at the handle Standing Up to POTS. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing to our podcast and sharing it with your friends and family. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at www.thepotscast.com. Thanks for listening.